Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on every Tuesday at noon on BCFM, Bristol Community FM 93.2. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Ellie Harrison, bringbackbritishrail.org is her campaign. Also, Tim Herford is back from the Transpersonals, talking about TV programmingers. Also, a look at one interpretation of the Eagles song from 1975, Hotel California. Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national do-it.org website. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Ellie Harrison, and I run the Bring Back British Rail campaign and have been doing so since 2009. And it was set up to just popularise the idea of renationalising our national rail network. 2009, it would have been 15 years since privatisation. More than that, actually. So it was starting to kind of get lost, this history that we actually used to have a publicly owned rail network, and especially for younger people who just didn't ever know that British Rail existed and didn't know something that they could demand that we move forward to in the future.
Now, we've got at the moment three kind of either ongoing or threatened strikes. We've got the problems down in Brighton and in the south of England with I think it's Southern Railway, or what used to be Arriva, I think they called it for a while, and it's some private company that runs the railways in the south of England, south of
Govia, it's called.
Oh, is it? Okay, Govia now. It's like Michael Govia. But anyway, some private firm that seems to be annoying people down there. The main reason for the strike, which the BBC never tell you, is that they're trying to remove guards from trains. I mean, that just puts all the responsibility on the driver, which is extremely difficult, particularly late at night, and especially on packed trains. And then there's the East Coast Main Line, and also Eurostar, which is, you know, the trains that go under the Channel Tunnel. So why do you think recently, just in the last few weeks, we've had all these, you know, I suppose people kind of tearing their hair out and saying, well, we've had enough of this private rail system?
Yeah. I think there's lots of things happening. I mean, I think most of the problems that we've got at the moment can be traced back to the failings of privatisation. And I guess increasing inequality on the railways, where you've got these fat cat bosses. And the example you mentioned, Govia, who run the biggest franchise, the biggest of all the rail franchises, because it was merged in 2014. It's called TSGN, which stands for the Thames Link, Great Northern and Southern franchises all rolled into one. And that's owned, Govia is owned by two companies, one called Go Ahead, which is actually a UK-based company, but the CEO of Go Ahead gets £2 million a year. And the other part of Govia is owned by the French state, owned by SNCF or their operations overseas, which is called Keolis. So actually some of the ticket prices and the profiteering that's going on across that whole big franchise in the southeast is going back to subsidise French railways. So what happened particularly on Southern is I think there were a lot of upgrades needed doing on that line. So the government just agreed, rather than award the contract as a normal rail franchise, as they call it, they'd do it as a management contract where they would just pay a set fee and Govia would run the service for that fee. So they realised, I think, because they're set up, obviously it's a profit-making enterprise, that if they cut services, then they could make more profit out of that set fees. Forget running these stupid franchising competitions as well, which cost £45 million per competition. And seeing that there's 11 of these competitions happening in the next 5 years, that's a hell of a lot of money just being wasted on going through all these really tedious bids, which are all from the same transport companies, because they're just, you know, there aren't actually enough companies set up on such a scale that they can bid for running a rail franchise. So, yeah, the East Coast is really interesting. And what happened in 2015, so quite appropriately, on the 1st of April, was that the Department for Transport decided to give away the publicly owned East Coast Railway to Virgin Trains East Coast, which is part owned by Virgin Trains and part owned by Stagecoach. And so for the last year, they've been running it. And of course, passenger satisfaction has nosedived as a result. The latest passenger satisfaction surveys show people are not happy with this new service. So the East Coast is an interesting story, but you think that this government wanted to reprivatise it as quickly as possible because it was an embarrassment, because it was all the proof we needed that public ownership is the most sensible, profitable, efficient way to run the railway. And that's what the majority of passengers want.
Also, what about First Group and First Great Western? They've kind of got rid of the First from their trains now. They're trying to make out, I think, that it was Brunel's company or whatever, that, you know, from the 1800s that's running it now. They've got a kind of green trains and a green logo, and you removing First from their kind of corporate identity. But here in Bristol, we're very much reliant on this service back and forth to London. What are the customer satisfaction like, and what stories have you got from this franchise?
Yeah, well, First Group, I mean, I actually live up in Glasgow, but I travel all around the UK for my work, because I work freelance. So I have been on every single one of these franchises, which is one reason why I started the campaign. And First, I think, they're an interesting company. They are UK-based. They're based in Aberdeen, actually. And they used to have a lot more of the franchises than they do now. They used to run the whole of ScotRail. And I think that they also made a bid to take over the West Coast mainline from Richard Branson as well. And there was a big fiasco in 2012 with that, because First Group got one of the figures in their franchise bid wrong. Apparently a zero was missed out. So one of the calculations was off by a factor of 10. So the DfT, the Department for Transport, had awarded them that West Coast franchise, and then Richard Branson made a legal challenge. This whole fiasco wasted £55 million, and in the end, they just allowed Richard Branson to carry on running the West Coast mainline. So First, since then, I think have kind of lost quite a lot of their franchises. They're not running ScotRail anymore. That's gone to Abellio, who are owned wholly by the Dutch state, actually. So they're now just left with two franchises. They're left with First Great Western, which is the one that you guys rely on, and they're left with the First Trans-Pennine Express. But what they decided to do last year was to rebrand both of these franchises to remove the word First, as you've rightly pointed out. And I actually see this as a success of the Bring Back British Rail campaign, in a way, because one of the things that we tried to do from the beginning was to expose what was really happening with the railways for people who don't quite understand, and quite understandably don't understand, because it's a ridiculously complex system. It doesn't need to be this complex, and it's almost overly complex to bamboozle people so that they're totally confused about who's actually profiting and who's actually accountable for their rail services. So FIRST decided to sort of go back to the good old days with their branding, and with the Great Western Railway, to almost claim that they were as good as the good old public service days of old. But of course, people, I think, were smart enough to see through this. And we did a lot of public awareness about it. Colleagues that we work with in the campaign called We Own It, who campaign for public ownership of all public services, they did a lot of public awareness about it. And hopefully people aren't going to be taken in by it and still realise that there's a lot of money being creamed off from their ticket prices by the FIRST group, which is completely unnecessary. And actually, on our website, one of the things that we've been building over the last year is what we call our franchises initiative. So we decided that actually the railway, because of privatisation, is broken up into all these little pieces around the country. But actually, that could be quite useful as a campaigning tactic if we can link up with grassroots groups in different parts of the country who are attacking these different private companies running their rail services. Then that becomes quite a good campaigning tactic. So we've been building these fact files about all of the different private companies and trying to encourage people in different parts of the country to get on board. And because we've got such a huge network now, got more than 100,000 people following us. So the idea really is to encourage campaigns for public ownership of railways in different parts of the country and to use our network to help support and promote those activities. So there is going to be some action happening in Bristol on Tuesday the 16th of August. Our colleagues at the Friends of Suburban Bristol Railways, who you might know, are going to be at Bristol Temple Meads on the 16th, handing out Action for Rail postcards, promoting the public ownership of the First Great Western Line, and of course the public ownership of all of the railways. Because one of the big arguments is that actually so much money is wasted on the railways because it's fractured and split up into all these tiny little pieces. And because you've got so much duplication of, well, duplication of CEO salaries, duplication of marketing budgets, you've got lack of sharing of information, you've got all these competing bids to take over the franchises. The simplest way to run a railway is to cut out all of that and reunify it into one national rail network. That's what's going to make it most efficient. That's what's going to make it most cost effective. And that's what's going to make it work most effectively, because we'll have 100% cooperation between all the different parts. And that's what you need to run a national rail network. So that's what we're fighting for.
Ellie, what about you? What got you interested in this?
Well, I got into it. You know, I wasn't a train geek. I didn't think.
You're not a train spotter?
I'm not a train spotter. Maybe I've become a bit of a train spotter over the last 7 years. But I was a pissed off passenger. I actually, Bring Back British Rail came about when I moved from Nottingham, where I used to live, to Glasgow, where I live now. And because I had a lot of friends still living in England, I was doing a lot of travelling. And it was then that I first realised quite how efficient the privatised rail network was, because you would have to make that journey between Glasgow and Nottingham go on three different franchises sometimes. And they just didn't care if one was late and you missed a connection and that would delay you by an hour. And then buying the tickets, I was always trying to plan my life like 3 months in advance so I could buy a ticket that I could actually afford. And I just started to think, why is nobody kicking up a fuss about this? You know, I actually have memories. I was born in 79, so I was 15 when the railways were privatised, and I had no clue what was happening. But I do have memories from the 80s of going on the intercity, British Rail intercity lines, and Just the simplicity, and you know, also the comfort of being in different parts of the country and recognizing that British Rail logo, knowing where you are with the train staff, the uniforms, the colours of the trains, just that simplicity.
Well, I'll tell you another thing that's changed a lot, and that is that they're packing people in, aren't they? One of the biggest problems here in the Paddington to Bristol, Temple Meads and down into Cornwall route is overcrowding, particularly between London, Reading, down that down end of the line, and everyone is packed in a tiny little space. The carriages, I mean, they could put double the number of trains on if people actually were going to get seats. Overcrowding seems almost like they're designed, these new trains, or the carriages have been redesigned to pack as many people in. They're like cattle trucks almost.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, so many of the problems we have on the railways are the result of what happens when you introduce a profit motive into an industry that is a natural monopoly, where there is, which is an essential public service, where there is absolutely no need, and it makes no sense for there to be a profit motive. Because if you look at, you know, if you're going to run one train and you want to make a profit out of it, then you want every single seat packed. You don't want to be running half-empty trains where people are sitting comfortably. You want every single seat to be full, and you want people standing in the corridor so you can maximise your profits. So I think that's probably the logic. What's going on? I think the train companies are just pushing it as far as they can go. You know, they're pushing the rail fares up as far as they can go. Some of the rail fares are regulated. Some of them aren't regulated at all. So they push, cram to maximise their profits, because that's what their profit-making companies are programmed to do. So I just think removing that unnecessary aspect of the railway is going to make things, you know, it's going to make passengers feel like they're actually being treated with respect on the railways, and to make rail staff actually feel like they are working for an organisation that they believe in and that respects them.
I wonder if, you know, you're as amazed as I am when I get on one of these packed trains at Paddington and there's all these people standing up, that they don't simply sort of swarm down into the first class carriage and sit down in one of those nice comfy seats, rather than sit there obediently standing up through, you know, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes of their journey.
Well, I do. You know, because I've always got my Bring Back British Rail t-shirt on anyway, and I've always, whenever I travel, and I've always got my Bring Back British Rail rail card wallet, which you can get on our website if you're interested, and all proceeds go towards the campaign. But I quite often just show those to the staff, especially, you know, if I was sitting in first class because there weren't any seats in standard class, or if somebody had the cheek to challenge me and say, well, you've got one specific type of ticket and you're not allowed to use it on this train, and all those nonsense rules that result from a privatised and fractured rail network, I just show them my Bring Back British Rail rail card wallet and say, didn't used to be like this. And quite often they'll just let me get away with it, because all the rail workers support it anyway. The only people that don't are the fat cat managers and CEOs who are profiting from the mess.
Sounds to me like it's quite well worth listeners buying one of these from your website, these little wallets.
So
do you want to just round up by letting us know whereabouts we can find you online and how to get in touch?
Yeah, sure. So 16th of August is the day of action. Go out to Bristol, Temple Meads. You'll see activists out handing out postcards. And find us online, bringbackbritishrail.org. And on Facebook, if you're on Facebook, just search for Bring Back British Rail. There's a huge number of supporters and lots of interesting active debate happening on our Facebook page and on Twitter, Bring Back BR.
Ellie Harrison from bringbackbritishrail.org. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, joining me is Tim Herford, as you were last week, Tim. Lovely to have you back. And maybe we can make a little bit of a habit of this, because it was I found it absolutely fascinating hearing your views on the sort of, I suppose, what's been a bugbear of mine over the years is the festival scene, having seen it slowly kind of corralled by these big fences at Glastonbury. But anyway, this week, television.
Television. Yeah.
Well, a lot of them certainly does seem to be lies. I certainly find myself looking at the news quite often and thinking, well, that's actually the opposite of the truth. And I think this has an effect, really, of kind of disengaging people with TV. Do you think?
Yeah. It's just pure programming, isn't it? And it always was. And I think that millions have woken, are waking up to the fact now. Since television was really came on the scene, when was that? The 1950s? 40s, 50s, you know? Before that, we had films, didn't we? Which was all propaganda, all the Nazi propaganda. That's how you could motivate and program so many people. You know,
but it wasn't. There were some rom-coms as well.
There was, but that's not what the major corporations are using it for sure.
So I guess the idea is you, a bit like the BBC, you have a whole load of truth being told, and actually some quite engaging stuff. And every now and again, you fire in a strategic lie.
Yeah, well, everyone's in a dream world. And that dream world is the television, the world of the television watcher, you know? And I'm finding, I haven't owned a television since 2004, so I haven't actually sat down in front of the TV and just gouged out in front of it for over a decade. And I live in a completely and utterly different reality.
Oh, but I suppose you watch video games and play video games, but you must have your TV in the house still.
Well, I've got a
monitor.
Yeah, I have access to the internet, obviously, and I spend far too much time engaging with digital media like that. But I also am not just passive, you see. I'm also engaging, like I am now. This is going to be on YouTube. It's going to get comments, going to make friends. And no longer under the tyranny of just being broadcast at.
There's a bit of a problem with the internet, isn't there? In that when you connect up to it, it connects up to you.
Yes,
and
it
starts to gather vast amounts of information of all the little intricate words that you put in as a search, and it gets builds up a whole profile about you.
Yeah, but who's studying that?
The National Security Agency, maybe?
I think there's obviously going to be some algorithms, and there's going to be some near enough artificial intelligence level quantum computing thing.
Well, look,
let me just explain.
I mean, I only found this out about a month ago when I was over at the Bilderberg meeting chatting to some tech people who'd come along to look at it. And that is that Google is simply another front end for what's a vast system which has been going for decades. And it's called, I mean, it was originally called Echelon in the 1990s and 80s. And what it does is it's all about keywords. So what Echelon originally did is it listened into, through Menwith Hill in Yorkshire, it listened into all of the phone lines in Britain simultaneously. So that sounds like quite an amazing job to do. But once the network had gone digital, in other words, we had digital exchanges put in the 1980s, it was possible that for the National Security Agency to listen into every phone call. And as it was listening to those phone calls, it would electronically scan them to look for these keywords. And the whole point was, I mean, for example, if you were to say the word IRA, it would probably be interested a little bit more in your phone conversation. And once you flagged up enough of these words through Echelon, then you would be put through to a real-time person at the National Security Agency who could listen to your conversation in real time. And obviously, well, first of all, it would be recorded. Then if it flagged up even more red lines for them, it would be listened to in real time. And in fact, whilst a conversation was going on, you could even be patched through to generals and people like that. So that's how that system worked. Google is just another front end for that. So as you're typing things in to search for Google, if you're typing the things that they don't want you to know about, say, for example, in the middle of the Turkish coup, if you're sitting in Turkey and you have Googled a way to find who's behind the coup and you've put some key names in there of people who are, and by the way, we found out what recently that to very close to the Turkish capital, there was a whole load of organisation going on in the coup. So at that point, these keywords and the person who's typing away then gets put through to live to a person at the National Security Agency. So you can watch your screen as you're doing things with it, possibly even switch your webcam on and say, who's this?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Now, watch this. Okay, Google. See, now, everything that we've just said was listened to by an artificial intelligence computer. It's only when I say, okay, Google, it springs up and says, yeah, what do you want? It's on all the time. They're listening all... That's in your pocket, everything you say, and there's a camera on there as well.
Well, one could
Pokemon.
One could get paranoid. One of the things about Pokemon, you mentioned that, I realise is... I mean, I didn't install it, but I had a look at it, and it wants every single permission from you.
Yeah.
From your phone. So if you want to play this game, it's a little game we're playing with you, and that is we want to know everything about you. We want to be able to do absolutely everything. We want your phone. And if you give us your phone, then you can play Pokemon Go.
Mm. Yeah. And also there is this is in the hands of anybody that wants to do it now as well, pretty much. If I wanted to spy on you, Tony, I'm pretty sure I could find out how to do it.
Well, I had a friend who's now working for Sky, for Murdoch, and he showed me, here I am in a chat room, and I'm chatting with police officers. They think I'm a kind of very nice young lady, and look, this is my picture. This is who they think they're talking to, but I'm in a chat room, and it's me, and I'm right here now live. Yeah. And that guy is a copper, and he was looking at the screen. So this is, you know, it's far too easy to do.
But it's going the other way as well, because then I don't think they're just scanning what everyone's saying. This is what I mean by propaganda, and they've been doing this with the TV, and now they are throwing out key words, if you like, but they're more like ideas, and they're people mimic, and they can control. You know, just think of like fashion, how easy it is to think of like fashions of behaviour. This is being. Well,
when you say fashion, then you mean fads. But I know also when I was working here in Picton Street before the good old Ethical Property Company did a rather nasty little eviction operation on me with no apparent reason. I don't know quite how ethical they think themselves to be. But anyway, before they did, I was sharing those offices with something called Fashioning and Ethical Industry, and they were a really good little organisation that looked at fashion companies around the world, people like Primark who were using slave labour. And by the way, Apple, who are using slave labour to make their equipment and sell it over here, and effective slave labour. And what they were saying was that there's actually only two companies in the entire world that choose what fashion is going to be in any part of the world. So this is very much controlled, this whole kind of culture. I suppose the banksters are the people who really own, because they can, I mean, they can say, for example, I'm running a company, and we've seen this on the high street with BHS and Marks and Spencers. You can put someone in charge of one of those companies who used to be in competition, who's just there to destroy it for the other company. And so you end up with no competition. So, and with M&S, I noticed also about 2 or 3 months ago, M&S cut all their wages for all their staff because they knew BHS is going down and that everyone was going to be afraid that they wouldn't be able to get a job if they lost their job at M&S. So they just thought, oh, we can just cut our wages. So they did.
Yeah, they're just chess pieces on a table, these major corporations.
So anyway, bankers.
Bankers.
They're sort of the new feudal dukes and kings and queens.
Of Westminster today, 25 years old, has inherited £9 billion.
Is he going to get taxed on that?
I think it's quite actually offensive. I find, just that somebody.
But maybe he's a nice guy.
Maybe he's a nice guy. Maybe he'll do something with that then. But it's before Rome minted coins, before money was invented, this is how it worked. It was all to do with. This is a little bit of research I did since the last show. I want to figure out how this all started. But if you had an excess amount of grain, you would donate that to your tribe and say, here you are, I've got an excess amount of grain. And then your social status would go up because everyone would go, wow, we've got like grain for everyone. Well done, mate. Pat on the back. And people would know it had a true moral, you know, people would look after everyone else. You would purposely try and make a profit to then give to the tribe. But it's the opposite these days. Oh yeah, I've got £9 million pounds. Thank you very much. That's mine. And now every restaurant that I walk into, I'm in the higher echelons of society. Everyone thinks I'm wonderful, and I naturally, wherever I go, get treated with respect just because I inherited £9 million pounds of actually nothing.
But you're never going to get rid of greed, are you?
He could get rid of it tomorrow and walk away with £1 million pounds and be the most popular man in this country. He's not going to do it, though, is he? Because he doesn't own that £9 million. It's not really his, is it? Because there's other people going, right, I'm your financial advisor, sir. We're going to do this and we're going to do that. And this is going to, and he's just a puppet for £9 billion floating around that other people are using, really. Don't you think? Am I wrong? Am I deluded?
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
You're
Have I worked anything out in my 39 years, or am I just an absolute deluded fool?
I'm not going to answer that.
I mean, give me £9 billion. Oh, and I would walk away with a million. But that's because I've been skint for 39 years. And I know how I could benefit.
I think, in a way, I suppose it might sound pie in the sky, but actually there's quite a lot to be said for totally renouncing money. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
If you can learn to live without money, you inherit the entire world. Because you walk out in the, because all you've got is the sky, the trees, the plants, your friends, real things. There's nothing shielding you from that eye of the needle that's hard to get a camel through. It's true.
So I'm actually best
that I've been skinned. I moan about it all the time, but, you know.
The Rothschilds.
Yeah.
They're the Frankfurt bankers who, I mean, there's quite a lot of good films about all this stuff. And I think probably one of the best is The Money Masters, which I saw a long time ago, which is Bill Still, who was a newspaper manager in the States. And he did The Money Masters, which was a fascinating tour through the history of money, including some basic stuff like the Bank of England using sticks of wood as money, which is a scene from that film I remember very well.
Yeah.
Why do people use sticks of wood for money?
Well, it's called a baton.
That's a great question. It's called a tally stick. It's called, and they split it in half, and the bank would pay you if you brought your half the stick back and it matched the other half.
Right.
So then you got the gold, you know, whatever. So that they used to do things like that. It was, yeah, very much, yeah. And the idea is that anything which the bank accepts as money or which the government accepts in payment of tax can be money.
Mm.
And that actually could extend to, even to abstract concepts, possibly. I mean, you know, but it's certainly things like Bitcoin now is exchangeable for gold, for real money. If you can call it real, because it's not backed, it's just bits of paper. So the Rothschilds' role in all of this is quite important in that when they started in Frankfurt, he then sent Mayor Amschel Rothschild, then sent his various sons to capitals around Europe, various capitals, London, Milan, Paris, Vienna, and they set up these Rothschild banks in those places. And the idea was that they were going to primarily lend to governments because governments always pay them back. Because a government can levy as much tax as it wants, or a king, or whatever. The other thing is funding both sides in a war.
Yeah.
Which they did.
And it's sport. Fact,
yeah. For example, so there's a story to do with the Duke of Wellington at the Battle of Waterloo, who he supposedly... I mean, the thing is, I say supposedly, but this was then later proved, because the Rothschild family tried to sue the journalist that wrote the story up and failed. But the idea being that they managed to get the message back to the City of London before anybody else. But what Nathan Rothschild did in London was to pretend that Britain and Wellington had lost.
Yeah.
So he started to sell.
Yeah.
And everyone else thought, well, we must have lost. So they started selling. And, of course, he was secretly buying up these stocks and shares at a very cheap price. So if you control and manipulate money like that, you can make a fortune.
Well, yeah, you can, yeah. And it's just, I'm sure he was having a great time doing it. But, you know, some people are just very talented and motivated in that way.
I mean, I see...
But not everyone is, and it, you know...
I see the Rothschilds as big brokers around the world. For example, with the Chinese, we've heard this story this week that Hinkley Power Station is... The Chinese are getting very annoyed because they were part of the finance of Hinkley Power Station. and that's now not happening. It's not going ahead for a while. The French company EDF Energy have had several resignations from their board, including the director of finance. And so, quite rightly, Theresa May is thinking, well, this doesn't look like a very good deal for us, but the Chinese are getting annoyed. Now, one person who's weighed in on the Chinese's behalf saying you've got to do this is Peter Mandelson, which is strange for the Labour Party. He's one of these sort of coup anti-Corbynites, coup people, and which suggests to me that he's this kind of international banker faction in the Labour Party.
Well, he could well be. He could be. He could be Count Dracula. He could be anything.
Anyway, look, talking...
You've got to see, I'm one of these people that I was talking about earlier on when it comes to the television. Before I stopped watching television, my whole life revolved around television. And when I was a little kid growing up, I wanted to be on the television. And my friend ended up being on the television and became quite famous. And because the television seemed like the real world, and the real world seemed mundane, ordinary, and not special in any way... This is the illusion of the television, is that everyone's staring through this window and they think there's a real world on the other side. And all of the news and all of the theatre on that thing is a complete and utter story. It's just, it's absolute illusion. It's a dream world. And if people can just really see that for what, like, you know, it, I think it takes a few years of not watching the television.
Well,
for it to really start to sink in, you know, just how much of a dream
for young people is. Don't watch it. I think for a lot of young people, it's just an irrelevance, and it's one of those old things that the older generation do that we just don't find interesting or relevant anymore. And of course, a lot of it is nonsense. It's just lies, propaganda, one sort or another. Whoever owns the transmitter is using it to try and make people think a certain thing, and you know, end of the story. Really, I mean, back when I were a lad, the 1970s, we had series like Doom Watch. I don't know if you've ever seen that. The Prisoner in 1969, I think that came out on ITV. The Survivors, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and one I still love to this day, which is Blake 7. Blake 7 was a version of, you know, Star Trek, where the Federation is this wonderful organization that runs the entire universe for the benevolent, but anyway, you know, these Americans are kind of enforcers around the universe for the Federation. Well, Blake 7 was a British version written by Terry Nation from the Doctor Who fame, and he just completely turned the whole thing on its head. He said, well, the Federation is the evil empire, and it's the little rebels that are fighting against it. They're the heroes. Right away around the galaxy, and they put it in this kind of intergalactic context, but we're not really getting anything. I mean, for example, on the BBC, where was the last time you saw a documentary about the Nazi faction in Britain and America after the war, after the Second World War? The people that helped the Nazis escape.
Well,
for example,
where's the documentary that NASA is actually the continuation of the Nazi Party? Where's that documentary?
The Nazi technology that took us to the moon.
Not only that, but you're saying that they're putting everything in intergalactic terms, yeah? Are they? Yeah, they are. It's a real dream world. I mean, it's a dream world. People are living in a dream world, man.
They are, I think. Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of people also that are kind of on social media more, and they do see it a bit cynically, Tim. So anyway, look, one of the things I thought we'd do as a bit of a treat this week is, I say a treat, is to look at this song from the Eagles, Hotel California, because I know you actually quite like the song, don't you?
I do.
Why?
It's a brilliantly written piece of music. I think it's a perfect song in terms of its you know, as a pop song, as in a very mysterious, very well performed, very charismatic. I don't know. Let's have a listen to it and see what comes out.
Well, just before we do, there's a guy called Tom on YouTube who gives a sort of 2 or 3 minute introduction to what he thinks of the lyrics. So let's hear Tom. Let's hear Hotel California by the Eagles, which I can remember as a secondary school, grammar school kid in mid-1970s listening to it thinking, crikey, that's quite a good song. I've no idea what it means, but it sounds good. And then we'll have a chat about it afterwards.
Hotel California, an album that came out in 1976 by the Eagles, as you probably all know. The guitarist, the electric guitarist extraordinaire Joe Walsh had just joined the group, and he brought with it a whole dynamic of electric rock that hitherto didn't exist. And the Eagles went basically from a country western pop crossover sound to country rock. So Hotel California, that was the great song on that album and went down as one of the greatest selling songs in the history of rock music, has given rise to endless debates as to what the lyrics really mean. They're very enigmatic and very cryptic, that's for certain. When you listen to them, most people say it's something about Southern Californian lifestyle, it's something about hedonism, but they're not quite sure. So when the Eagles are interviewed themselves, what story do they tell? Because let's start with that. They say it's about the jaded, blasé, hedonistic lifestyle that characterizes Southern California. And indeed, when you listen to the song, their lyrics about mirrors on the ceiling, pink champagne on ice, Mercedes Benz, and it sounds a little bit like the epitome of that type of lifestyle. However, there are other interpretations, perhaps a little bit more penetrative and perhaps a little bit more titillating and even darker. One of the interesting ones is that the whole song is a metaphor for a drug trip. And the Hotel California, THC, spells out, of course, the principal components in grass, which, needless to say, was extremely popular during that period in Southern California. So if you look at the beginning of the song, on a dark desert highway, cool wind in my hair, warm smell of Calitas rising up through the air. Calitas actually can be a code word for grass. Then a woman appears out of nowhere. There she stood in the doorway. I heard the mission bell. I was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this can be hell. So it could be a whole initiation into drugs. But as interesting as that is, I'm going to develop a little bit in more detail the third and slightly more somber interpretation. Rumor has it that the Eagles, at the height of their success, had been lured into the Church of Satan under the auspices of the great satanic priest Anton LaVey of sinister repute. And that they wrote this song in a masked way. They daren't speak about Satanism openly, but they masked the lyric inside the song. Now, if you open the album at the time where they still had albums, you'll see the inside of a hotel lobby, and in the back window, you see a man dressed in robes, black robes, with a shaved head. And lo and behold, if you zoom in on it, that figure is Anton LaVey. Now, the Church of Satan was established in 1969 in California, and basically its tenets are hedonism, living to the hilt, a disregard of traditional morality, and indulging fully in the senses, and particularly the sensual senses. So let's run through the song a little bit. So here's this man who's on a dark desert highway. My head was dizzy, my sight grew dim, I felt I had to stop for the night. So he's feeling a little bit dizzy and strange. All of a sudden, a woman appears. There she stood in the doorway. I heard the mission bell, and I was thinking unto myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. First indication of something sinister. And then she lit up the candle and she showed me the way. There were voices down the corridor, and I heard them say, "Welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place, such a lovely face." The face of Anton LaVey overlooking the congregation inside the hotel. So here all of a sudden we start to sense that maybe there's something more than meets the eye in these lyrics. Then it continues. Mirrors on the ceiling, pink champagne on ice, and we are all prisoners here of our own device. Hedonism, bordellos, champagne, and they're prisoners of our own device. Why are they prisoners? One of the tenets of the Church of Satan is that once you enter in and sell your soul to Satan, you are prisoner for all eternity. Because even if you try to redeem yourself, your soul belongs to Satan. So it continues. She talks about how they dance in the courtyard, sweet summer's sweat. Some dance to remember, some dance to forget. They're in a trip where they're trying to forget something. What are they trying to forget? Now we come to the lyrics that perhaps are indisputable in the eyes of some in relating to Satanism. I asked the captain, "Please bring me my wine." He said, "We haven't had that spirit here since 1969. A play on words. The spirit of Christ has not been in this church since 1969, when a satanic and black mass was told and they expelled the Holy Spirit from the church. So, you see, even I'm starting to feel the sinister vibes of Satanism rising up within me." And then it goes on. They gather in the master's chamber. They stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. The beast, of course, from Revelation, is the Antichrist on earth. Anton LaVey many times claimed to be the incarnation of Satan and the beast on earth. So stabbing with steely knives, but not managing to kill us, reminds us of what? Of the ritual of exorcism. And what they're saying basically is all the power in the world and all the magic or all the mystical things you can bring to bear will not kill the spirit of the evil one. Because Satan, according to Satanists, is going to overcome Christ in the final apocalyptic conflict. And towards the end of the song, I can't go into all the lyrics, relax, said the nightman, we're programmed to receive. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. Anton LaVey says that he programmed his disciples to be completely obedient to him. Now, for those of you who are not American, to check out is also a colloquial way of saying commit suicide. So even if you commit suicide and check out definitively, you can never leave because your soul belongs to Satan.
Check out any
From 1975, that's Hotel California by the Eagles, off the album of the same name. Tony, interesting, eh?
Well, I wonder, you know, there's all sorts of lyrics in there, and all sorts of things he was talking about. Checking out any time you want,
yeah.
You can never leave.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a bit like the European Union.
It is like the European Union. It's like, and it's also like today's modern pop culture, big mainstream I'm talking about, main stage Glastonbury, pyramid stage acts. I'm talking Jay-Z, I'm talking Kanye West, or Satanic.
Well, I would. One thing I would pick a bone over with Tom there is when he talks about a lovely face. This to me speaks of something that looks nice. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole point being, is it really nice?
Exactly.
What's behind the face?
Katy Perry.
And exactly. Not necessarily. And also, there's this figure, he says, he talks about Anton LaVey looking out over the, you know, it's one of those gatefold albums. When you open it up, it's got this thing in there. And I mean, I have had a look at this gatefold album. To me, I'm not convinced that's Anton LaVey in there. The sort of thing is, looking back at that from my memory of the 70s, that sort of thing was incredibly compulsive to a teenage kid like me. I mean, you look at this, you think there's loads of really cool-looking people at a marvellous sort of party in the middle of this gatefold album.
Yeah.
These are the kind of people I want to be with. You know, I'd like to go to that party.
Yeah, yeah.
Seductive.
And same today. Like Miley Cyrus, okay, looks nice. Hannah Montana, Disney. All nice and innocent, isn't it? But it's soft porn for children. I mean, come on, it's right in your face. Now, listen to this. This is Kanye West from the song Monster. Murder, murder in black convertibles. I kill the block. I murder avenues. I rape and pillage a village, women and children.
It sounds to me like the sort of stuff you play in a tank as you're mowing down civilians, you know, in a real war, that kind of thing. And they do actually encourage them to.
It's negative energy to get a negative reaction, and everybody comments, this is crap, this is rubbish, this is all this, or they love it, and the middle class just go along with anything. You're Wellington boot wearing.
Back to the Eagles, 1975.
Yeah.
You stab them with their steely knives, but you just can't kill the beast. Well, the beast is not Anton LaVey. The beast, or whatever, in Revelation, I think. It's just the devil. This is the devil. The
beast is a system.
Well, Babylon is the system.
Babylon is the system. That's correct. Yeah, and that's anyway, America, and coming out of Great Britain and Western culture.
And actually, it was interesting to see on a BBC programme just a couple of weeks ago, Martin Wolf from the Financial Times and Bilderberg talking about the whole idea of interest coming from Babylon. Mm. You know, so even these people who are speaking for the criminal elite are telling us some stuff if we bother to listen. Anyway, Tim, lovely to have you in again.
Yeah, sorry about all the silly things I said. If I said anything silly, I don't want to offend anyone.
Well, okay, me cool. Too. And we'll maybe hear from you in a couple of weeks when you're back from your trip to Ireland.
Sure.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Ellie Harrison from bringbackbritishrail.org up in Glasgow. Also thanks to Timothy Herford, talking there about the TV programming us as if we're all computers. Also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Losers, and you're just a bunch of losers. Oh, you must have been a crazy game. Losers. million dollars for your core. For sure, I'd really rather have no passion at all. It's very cleansing for the soul to have no passion at all. Another thought, another thought.